Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and as ever, I would like to begin by thanking Hans and Gulchen for their great goodness in having invited me to this conference year after year, and I do hope that their goodness will continue into the future. Before I begin my main speech, I would very humbly draw your attention to the rather tasteful leaflets that Benjamin Marx has distributed to you. This is a novel which has received much critical praise and been nominated for the 2015 Prometheus Award. If you do buy it, I shall be most grateful. And if you could perhaps tell me if you can still identify one or two typos in it, I shall be just as grateful, though doubtless the more typos you identify, the redder Robert Gruetzinger's face will go, because he proofed it. That brief commercial promotion being made, let us move to the main proceedings of my half hour. As I look ahead, I am filled with foreboding. Like the Roman, I seem to see the river Tiber foaming with much blood. I may have fellow countrymen who are unable to identify these words. If so, I have not yet met them. The words, of course, are from the speech that Enoch Powell gave on the 20th of April 1968 to the West Midlands Area Conservative Political Centre, otherwise known as his Rivers of Blood speech. It is almost certainly the most notable political speech given by an Englishman during my lifetime. I'm willing to say that it is the most notable political speech given in England during the 20th century. It made its author at once the most loved and the most hated politician in Britain. A few days after he delivered the speech, dock workers marched through the centre of London shouting, "Enoch is right." In 1998, at his memorial service in Westminster Abbey, a vast crowd of people, unable to get into the cathedral, stood on the pavement outside to show their respects. At the same time, if you are inclined to commit professional suicide in any particular trade or calling, not excluding sport or taxi driving, the surest and fastest means of self-dispatch is to be heard muttering, "Enoch was right." The people who now rule my country, and who have ruled it for some years, hate and fear Enoch Powell. As time has gone by, the chorus of execration has grown both more grim and more shrill. They do not like Enoch Powell. Now, I could spend my half hour this morning explaining at length what Enoch Powell said about immigration and what he meant about it. Or, if you want a particularly entertaining half hour, I could simply read you his Rivers of Blood speech. Like everything else he said or wrote, it is a masterpiece of English prose. However, I've been asked to speak about Enoch Powell, the politician, and what I will say is that Enoch Powell is much more than complaints about immigration. Oh, immigration is part of the story. Immigration is a big part of the story, and I will return to it. But of all British politicians during my lifetime, Enoch Powell was by far the most systematic and consistent, and I think it is a good idea to set what he said about immigration in the full context of his thought. you may say that to use phrases like systematic and consistent and British politician are at least pretentious. But Enoch Powell was no ordinary British politician. Not for him a PP at Oxford, during which time he sucked up to anyone who might advance his career later in life, followed after graduation by a job straight away in Westminster. No, Enoch Powell's degree was in classics at Cambridge, where he studied under the great poet and scholar A.E. Housman, and where he took a double starred first, a most remarkable and rare degree. Even before, at the age of 25, he became the youngest professor of Greek in the British Empire, he was widely seen as the most brilliant classical scholar of his generation. He re-edited Thucydides for the Oxford University Press. His Lexicon to Herodotus, published in 1928 when he was 26, remains one of the standard works on an historian who, after all the changes of 2,400 years, remains the most famous citizen of Bodrum, or Halicarnassus, and whose statue is still to be seen down in the harbour. Enoch Powell was deeply read in German philosophy. He was more than a competent economist. He was an expert on the medieval House of Lords. He was fluent, as well as in Greek and Latin, as one must be. He was fluent in German, in Portuguese, in French, Italian, and Spanish. Oh, and Urdu. He knew Welsh and Russian and Syriac and Aramaic. Not a standard British politician. It is not at all. It is not at all pretentious to call him systematic and consistent. And he did come late to politics. He was in his 30s when he joined the Conservative Research Centre. However, his remarkable talents were immediately recognised by the Conservative Party, and he rose through the party like a bubble through water, winning a seat in Parliament in 1950. And if it would be several more years before he had developed all of the views that we now call Powellite, it is, I repeat, not at all inappropriate to use the words systematic and consistent when talking about Enoch Powell. So let me try to summarise his system. As a Tory, he would have furiously rejected the notion that he had a system, but, well, he had one. For Enoch Powell, the two most significant dates in British history are 1760 and 1947. Before the earlier of those two dates, Britain was a European nation-state, a somewhat eccentric European nation-state in terms of its domestic arrangements, and an unusually rich and powerful nation-state. But it was a European nation-state. And then, around 1760, Britain became a world empire, with possessions in India, in North America, and in the Mediterranean. And although it took a century, and indeed it perhaps took more than a century, for the political class in my country to understand the full implications of what had happened during the Seven Years' War, it became necessary for the political class of Britain to think not purely in terms of the interests of the home islands, but in terms of the welfare of an increasingly large world empire. It became necessary for British politicians to pay attention to the disputes between Turkey and Russia, because these were both neighbours or near neighbours of our possessions in India. It became necessary for British politicians to pay as much attention to the doings of the Qazi of Calabar as to the doings of the Austrian Emperor. We had concerns in North America. We had concerns in the Far East. We fought wars with China. We established bases in South Africa because we needed to control the land routes to India. And as soon as the opening of the Suez Canal in 1871 opened up a short route to India, our long-term obsession with the land route became a burning obsession with control of the entire East Mediterranean. We took Cyprus from the Turks as a naval base. We had to pay very close attention to the unwillingness or inability of the King of Egypt to pay his debts. We had to take over the Suez Canal. And because we took the Suez Canal, we had to take Aden and Mombasa and put garrisons there and take over the Seychelles. And we had to secure the entire sea route, long and short, to India. We had to think imperially. Now, even as the magnificence of this achievement began rather late in the day to impress itself on the late Victorian imagination, the empire was coming under strains that would eventually tear it apart. Powell himself recalled the British Empire in India a long hallucination, which even in India couldn't last forever. As for the colonies of white settlement in North America and the South Pacific, these had from the earliest been given British institutions. And as those institutions grew, it was inevitable that Australia, New Zealand, Canada, what have you, would become freestanding, independent nations. The empire was, for Enoch Powell, a passing phase in our history. And then in 1947, the second of the dates I mentioned, it ended. The two wars against Germany had been a great deal more expensive than anyone had expected. And by 1945, the country was bankrupt, or verging on the edge of bankruptcy, and it was simply impossible to maintain British rule in India, which accordingly, in 1947, was given its independence. And for Enoch Powell, this was the end of the empire. Because we no longer controlled India, we didn't need Cyprus as or for a naval base. We didn't need to garrison Aden and Mombasa. We had no concern whatsoever with what the Russians might be doing on the northern borders of Afghanistan. If China turned communist or fascist, that had virtually zero impact on the well-being of the United Kingdom. It was necessary for the politicians, as quickly as possible, the liquidation of what remained of the empire after India left should be done with some regard for order and decency and with some regard for the well-being of the subject peoples of the empire, but it was over. India had gone, the rest was just so much rubbish to be cleared up as quickly and tidily as possible. It was time for the British political class to start thinking in exactly the same way as Walpole and Bolingbroke and other politicians of the early 18th century had done. The sole concern of the British government was to control the sea approaches to the home islands, and to attend to the commerce and manufacturing of the home islands, and to preserve the rights and liberties and to promote the general welfare of the British people. That was the whole duty of a British politician after 1947. Sadly, the British political class failed to accept the logic that Enoch Powell claimed to have detected. Instead of being dragged slowly and reluctantly towards a full understanding of the logic of our new position, they decided to embark on three generations of self-delusion. They told each other, the empire has not fallen, dear boy. It has simply transformed itself into the Commonwealth of Nations. It is a gentler and a kinder version of the British Empire, but it is still in itself a great power, able to look the Americans and the Russians in the face, and able, whenever possible, to mediate between those rather vulgar powers. If you look through the collected speeches of David Cameron, a somewhat arid exercise, I will confess, you will occasionally find phrases such as, Britain is able to punch above its weight. The eyes of the world are upon us. And of course, if you look beyond these pronouncements to our actions in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Sierra Leone, in Serbia, virtually all over the world in the past 20, 40, 60 years, you will see the continued delusion that Britain is a great world power, able and indeed obliged to think in global terms. And Enoch Powell spent his life denouncing this view, exposing the delusion. It was completely unnecessary. Let me quote from a speech he delivered in 1961. And yet England is not Nineveh and Tyre, nor as Rome, nor as Spain. Herodotus relates how the Athenians, returning to their city after it had been sacked and burnt by Xerxes and the Persian army, were astonished to find, alive and flourishing in the blackened ruins, the sacred olive tree, the native symbol of their country. So we today, at the heart of a vanished empire, amid the fragments of demolished glory, seem to find like one of her own oak trees standing and growing, the sap still rising from her ancient roots to meet the spring, England herself. Fine words, as I said, he was a master of English prose. But sadly again, the British political class was deaf alike to beautiful prose and to cold logic. The self-delusion went on and on and on. And this is the key to understanding virtually everything that Enoch Powell said or wrote. These two dates, 1760 and 1947, between those two dates, Britain was a world empire, and it was appropriate for the political class to think imperially, to think globally, to use the modern expression. After 1947, it was simply a matter of looking after the home islands. Nothing else was particularly important. We didn't need to get involved in the Cold War against Russia, because Russia is a long way from my country. And how could the Russians fight their way through Germany, France, and any other intervening country, all the way to the English Channel, and establish air and sea superiority and get enough soldiers across to conquer my country? Did they want to? Could they do it? Of course not. And so we had no need to get involved in the American game of chess across the world, the nuclear chess. We didn't need nuclear weapons because we were not going to be attacked by a first-rate military power. We didn't need to deter the Russians. We didn't need a policy east of Suez. We didn't need to get involved in any of the problems into which we threw ourselves repeatedly after 1950. But rather than talk vaguely about what Powell thought, and rather than try to take you through every one of his positions on his opposition to socialism and inflation, his hostilities to the European Union, his dislike of the police state that our ruling class fitted us out with after 1950, and so on and so forth. Let me try to illustrate the nature of his thought by looking at just two parts of it. One is his opinion of the United States, and the other is his opinion of immigration. The United States. Britain, after 1950, behaved rather like a man who has lost his job, but who still every morning gets up, puts on his business suit, and buys a railway ticket to his place of work, his former place of work. And when he finds that the cost of railway travel is beyond his means, he will beg and borrow the fare from anyone inclined to lend it. Which, to drop the simile, means strategic reliance on the United States. We can only punch above our weight if we suck up to the Americans and belong to the right international bodies. But has America any particular regard to British interests? No. Should America have any particular regard to British interests? No. And then you look at the nature of America. Now, we can all in this room agree on the frequent lunacy of the American political class. What I would say, and what I think, without being able to track it down, because Powell's comments on America were a very small part of his output, but what I think Powell would have said about America is that if you're an American, unless you want to deny your own birthright, you are required to hate and to despise England. It is very difficult to adopt the language and the legal traditions. Sorry, it is very difficult for one nation to adopt the language and the legal and constitutional traditions of another nation. Because the language and those traditions are organic only to that other nation. It can be done, it has been done. The Byzantines did it with Greek and Roman culture. The Brazilians appear to have done it with regard to Portugal. But it requires that other nation to be dead or of utter insignificance in the world. The problem for the Americans during much of their history is that the language they spoke and the traditions they had adopted were organic to a great and powerful nation, which was, in many respects, a rival to the United States. And so in 1917, and again in 1940, we called on the Americans for help in our wars against Germany. And the help, let us not deny it, was given with lavish hand. Yet if, after the Great War, the fruits of what the Americans had bought were snatched away, after 1940, the Americans made sure to grab those fruits and never to let go of them. And the fruits I'm talking of were the reduction of my country to satellite status and the use of Britain simply as a projection of American power, and nothing more. Therefore, we were suffered by the Americans to fight communism in Malaya during the 1950s, because the Americans wanted that. It fitted in with their crusade against world communism. Yet when the Americans told us to stop in 1956 from taking back the Suez Canal, we did stop. Even if Britain had turned coldly power-like after 1950, it would have been necessary to take account of America's strategic supremacy in large parts of the world. But with our self-deluded ruling class, on the one hand saying we can punch above our weight, on the other hand whispering in American ears, come on, dear boy, give us privileged access to some technology. Can we have those weapons on a, you know, can we have it on easy payments over 20 years? You know, give us some help. When you have a ruling class doing that, it inevitably involves us in endless problems and humiliations. Powell did not dislike the United States. He did not blame the Americans for doing what they did. They were simply following their own national interest, which is what every country can and indeed should do. Powell's denunciation was for the British political class, which either was not aware of what was going on or didn't wish to be aware of what was going on. I now turn to immigration, and I realise that I'm running out of time, so I shall be quick about this. Enoch Powell cannot be regarded as a white nationalist. I don't think Enoch Powell would really have had much time for Jared Taylor and Richard Spencer. Richard Lynn told me that when William Shockley turned up in London, Shockley was a race realist, and he got in touch with Enoch Powell saying, let's talk, I'm sure we have much to discuss. Powell wrote back saying, I don't think we have anything to discuss. When you are fluent in Urdu, and when indeed you take the time and trouble to become a scholar of Urdu poetry, it is very difficult for you to be accused of regarding the speakers of that language as somehow inferior human beings. Enoch Powell's objection to mass immigration was not the black and brown faces and the funny cooking smells. His objection was that they were not our people. Simple as that. He did say notoriously once that if a million Germans had turned up in England, he would have been just as horrified. These people were in the nation, but not of the nation. Their physical presence caused great inconvenience to the natives, or simply displaced the natives. And the moral fact of their presence made it very difficult for the nation to be governed according to its ancient ways. That is the essence of Enoch Powell's opposition to mass immigration. He said repeatedly when David Frost, for example, tried to entrap him into some untoward expression, he denied any feelings of racial supremacy or the inherent goodness of the white race. No, his entire objection, as I said, was that these were not our people. And although if there had been an immigration from the Commonwealth of a few hundred thousand, and that these people had remained confined to one or two clearly defined areas, it was something that we could have accommodated. The open-ended immigration of the 1950s and 60s was liable to undermine the whole country. Now, when we look at the great immigration that began in the 1990s into our countries, we tend to explain it in terms of the cultural Marxist hypothesis. I think in the 1950s and 60s, though this hypothesis was not entirely absent, the main driving force was again the self-delusion of our ruling class. The British Empire had a single citizenship. Somebody born in India had exactly the same rights as somebody born in Birkenhead. And so as the empire was transformed into Commonwealth, the myth of its continuing organic unity had to be maintained by insisting that the citizens of the Indian and Pakistani republics, and indeed the inhabitants of every other territory actually or formally coloured red on the map, had exactly the same right to live and settle in Britain, and to work, and to vote, and to enjoy all the rights and responsibilities and benefits of other British citizens as my own parents. It is a self-delusion which was only partially and reluctantly given up in the 1961 Commonwealth Immigration Act. But that took enormous effort and indeed protests on the streets before a Conservative government filled with the remnants of an imperial ruling class were willing to lift a finger. Now that explains Enoch Powell's opposition to mass immigration. My conclusion. I suppose my conclusion is redundant because it should be clear from the tone and the content of what I've already said. But I do regard Enoch Powell as by far the greatest statesman of my lifetime and perhaps of the 20th century. I am very proud to have attended a number of his speeches and to have spoken with him and to have corresponded with him. And I still rejoice in my possession of many signed volumes of his writing. I'm also very proud to direct an organisation, the Libertarian Alliance, which hosted some of Enoch Powell's speeches and which published some of his writings, most notably his denunciation of the Drug Trafficking Offences Act 1984, which introduced civil asset forfeiture into English law. I believe that in 100 years' time, none of the corrupt entities who nowadays hyperventilate about the wickedness of Enoch Powell will be remembered. But I have not the slightest doubt that in 100 years' time, the writings of Enoch Powell will be read and studied with great interest and with great profit. And I rather hope that in 100 years' time, it will not, as at present, be an informal crime to say loudly and looking your listeners in the eye, Enoch was right. So, with those words, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank you for your indulgence.